The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk
on 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show on a tough day, brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. What an astonishing day. After an astonishing week, after a difficult month, and it feels like it's been compounded from every single corner. We're going to pick up on the reality of where we are in terms of food security, in terms of the cost of everything in our economy and how that's rising. And again, we're not isolated. This isn't a South Africa problem. This is a global problem. We feel it here because this is where we live. This is where we spend the little bit of money that we have. And so therefore, it's incredibly personal, and it does open the way for political opportunism, but it doesn't fix the problem. You could demand as much as you like that global prices of commodities change, but it doesn't make them happen. And so we're going to look at the risks this evening that the country faces from that perspective. Also tonight, Super Saver Julia and how she is doing in the world of investments. It's a July thing that we do in what used to be called Savings Month. I've not heard many Savings Month ads this month in July. Usually lots. I'm not hearing them. Am I missing something, producers? Am I missing something? Is there a sense of saving, or are financial institutions keeping their heads below the parapet on that particular front? Also today, huge sell-off in commodities. That's led to a massive sell-off on shares on the JSE. It's ugly. It's hard. It's messy. We'll tell the entire tale between now and 8.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
And up first this evening, a fabulous insight from Maya Fisher-French, and I thought it would be valuable to get her onto the show. I would laugh if it wasn't so ridiculous. This idea, you can have multiple measures of inflation and you can pick the one that suits you. You can leave out the bits that don't suit you. So the US, for example, has got an inflation target of 2%, and their inflation rate yesterday spiked to over 9%. So it's pretty serious, and it's very hair-raising. But if you left out food and energy costs, well, then inflation dipped to a far more attractive 6%. Here's the one thing we all do have in common, and that's a need for food and a need for energy. So to suggest you can simply ignore those cost pressures is simply ridiculous. And food and energy form the part, probably the lion's share of most South Africans' budgets. But there was a wonderful observation today from you, Maya Fisher-French, the founder, the editor, the chief writer on mayaonmoney.co.za. And that's your observation on fuel prices. Good evening.
Good evening, Bruce. Yep, we're all on fuel at the moment, aren't we? Just feels painful, really, really painful.
Absolutely. So what was that observation?
So I went to fill up yesterday, and I have a 70-litre tank. So I have a fairly big tank that I have to fill up. And the bill was just over 1,800 rand. And what I realized was that's actually what the old age pension is. So if you are a pensioner who relies on the government social grant, that's what you get for a month to live off, what I put in a tank of fuel. And I think that really just highlights this massive disparity and obviously this massive poverty problem that we have in South Africa.
And it comes down to the question, I suppose, is the fuel price too high or the social grant too low? Or probably a combination of both. I wonder what your thoughts are on that. WhatsApp this evening, I'd love your thoughts on the cost of living crisis, which is not only domestic, but certainly is global. But we feel it here. And Maya's illustration of the cost of a tank of fuel for her vehicle, a 70-litre tank, is that it costs as much to fill that tank as old age pensioners get in form of a social grant. The brutal truth here, Maya, is although our official inflation rate sits at 6.5% in South Africa, which by global standards right now is fairly muted, the vast majority of people are spending the vast majority of the little bit of money that they have simply on surviving as best they can because of particularly food and energy costs.
Mm. Absolutely. And I mean, one of the comments I always get is people say, what is this inflation rate they're talking about? Because it's not what my inflation rate is. And of course, the inflation rate puts in a whole bundle of things. One of the things that has come down actually is rental, for example. So people, if they're paying rent or, that in that basket's gone down, so electronics go down, certain things, the way they weight the basket. But, when we feel that the things that we have to pay, we do need to fill up with fuel. We do need to pay for electricity. We do need to put food on the table. So those are not really ones we can avoid. And I think that's why they hurt so much. It's easy to say, the price of watches has gone up. I don't need to buy a watch. Or the price of cell phones has gone up. I don't need to buy a cell phone. But those are the things that have actually come down in price, which is lowering the overall inflation basket. So it is this kind of weird scenario. But Bruce, I think it is also worth mentioning that we've been here. We actually are still in South Africa trending with a much lower inflation rate than we have had historically. And I think that's also important to remember. Yes, prices go up, but they're still not going up at the same rate that they did, in the late 90s, the early 2000s. We've actually really moderated our inflation. And the fact that we are now have an inflation rate lower than the US currently, I think, we must also observe that and just be very aware of it. And just one comment you asked the listeners, should it be, is the social grant too low or fuel price too high? I think the problem is the fact that people live on social grants and the unemployment in this country. And I think that's the factor that we have in South Africa that no one else in the world has. It's an incredibly high unemployment rate that is making all of these prices hurt so much more.
Maya Fisher-French, thank you so much for that wonderful perspective this evening. Personal finance journalist at Maya on Money. Listening to that is Andy Duplessis, the managing director at Food Forward. I get my teeth in. Food Forward South Africa. Andy Duplessis regularly talks to us about issues in providing food for people who so desperately need it. And the food inflation number in South Africa is a terrifying one, Andy, as well. And you've been doing some calculations on average, what food baskets are costing more than a year ago.
Absolutely. Hi, Bruce. Thank you very much for having us. What we do is, on an annual basis, we take a look at very specific products, mostly basic products, and we track the prices at two different retailers year on year. And we've seen, between last year and this year, 12.9% increase over a range of products, most notably cereals, fruit, vegetable, grains, and spreads. So although CPI is sitting at 6.5%, we are finding that food inflation, when you specifically isolate it, that is just the price difference is just exorbitant between last year and this year. And then those figures don't even take into account the kind of issues we're having because of the Russia-Ukraine crisis right now, where cooking oils and wheat and all those prices are just going through the roof.
I mean, we're not talking here about bottles of champagne and I don't know how you buy truffles, little bags of truffles or whatever. This is the stuff that people survive on. I mean, this is, and you break it down, I mean, fresh fruit prices, and I'm stunned by this number, fresh fruit prices on average up 62%. Vegetables 9%, cereals up by 23%, grains by 12%, and the spreads, I'm assuming things like peanut butter and others, which people use as a more affordable form of protein on a slice of bread, to help it go down a little easier as well. I mean, that's up nearly 35%, up by more than a third. I mean, these are enormous sort of increases in real basics.
Absolutely. These prices are not sustainable. And what we are finding more and more, Bruce, is that poor people have to continue to buy cheaper and cheaper foods. And it's just it's just a vicious cycle, because you eat cheaper foods, then we talk about obesity and hypertension and even non-communicable diseases that are just growing. And we find that while poor people have to eat cheaper food, they are growing unhealthier, which has an added burden on the health sector, and unhealthy people don't have the strength to go and look for work. So it's just a vicious cycle, this poverty and inequality that seems to be going round and round, and it's just worsening across South Africa.
I mean, you make your reason for existence at Food Forward South Africa is to take food and repurpose it and to stretch it as far as it will go to try and provide basic meals for people who desperately need the food. How's the demand for the service you provide growing in this environment?
Jeebus, we have seen a 122% increase year on year in the number of applications into our organization. People are crying out. We are inundated. We receive applications. We used to, 2 years ago, we received 20, 30 applications a month. These days, we are receiving 400, 500 applications a month, and 80%, 90% of them don't qualify according to our very specific criteria, unfortunately. So we are seeing a huge shift where more and more people, because they are unemployed, because they're taking care of families, because the school feeding program is not really fulfilling the needs of the majority of our school-going children, we are finding that the demand for food is going through the roof because people simply can't afford to buy just basic groceries. And the NISCRAM report has showed that over a four-week period, for 1 or 2 weeks, families are going without food for that period, which is a concern. And as you're aware, South Africa has the highest rate of stunting or malnutrition for children in the world. And so and in the Eastern Cape at the beginning of this year, we read reports of 12 children dying of malnutrition. So what we are seeing is in households that are just not coping, children are slowly wasting away.
They're starving to death. They're starving. I mean, let's be blunt here, Andy. We've got, in a country that is food secure, in a country that produces plenty of food, we've got kids starving to death in their own homes.
Absolutely, and that's just a contradiction with our supply chain. We have enough food in this country, absolutely, but more than 10 million tons of that food is lost or wasted throughout the supply chain, from farmers right through to producers, manufacturers, and the retail space. Huge amount of good edible, good quality food is ending up in landfill, being incinerated, when that food could be used to feed people. And that's the conundrum.
Are you getting the support you need to help fill this massive, massive gap, Andy?
So we are getting support from corporates and individuals that people are more sensitized to what's happening around them. As you've heard with your previous interviewer, people are paying large amounts for fuel now. When you go to the shops, food prices increase. So people are more and more sensitized to this. But the problem we have is that as food insecurity worsens in underserved communities, government is not responding in a like-minded way. And they're leaving the non-profit sector, organizations like Food Forward SA, to carry the can. And we are finding that organizations are running out of resources. People are becoming jaded in terms of being able to donate and support because their own disposable incomes are shrinking, and government is not coming to the party. And our view is that the right to food is a constitutional right, and government is not creating an enabling environment for that to happen. Government must support non-profit organizations that are addressing food insecurity issues in those underserved communities to stave off hunger, to stave off malnutrition, Bruce.
If there's one failure, one government department that's failing in doing its job, what is it? Social welfare? Is it another department? Which one is it?
It's the Department of Social Development. It's their mandate to make sure that they create that enabling environment. And we've been trying to get a meeting with the minister, and it has not come. I've got the minister's details on my phone. I email her constantly.
Who is the minister? Who is the minister at the moment? I've lost track because they've got no profile whatsoever, it would seem. Who is the Minister of Social Development?
Lindiwe Zulu, Minister Zulu.
Okay. I mean, yeah, Minister Lindiwe Zulu, you're not doing your job. Your department's not doing its job. Andy du Plessis needs to have a word. Could you make contact, please? Just return his calls. It's that simple. Andy du Plessis, thank you. Managing Director at Food Forward South Africa. Government failures all over the place, and it's being felt in the stomachs of young kids, and kids are starving to death at home. How does that make you feel? I mean, that's as blunt as it is. Children are starving to death in South Africa. Enjoying your supper?
The Money Show.
The Markets.
From that cheerful perspective on the world to another cheerful perspective on the world, I drip with sarcasm as I tell you that global markets in a very sharp pullback today after yesterday's inflation number out of the United States. And again, we're very critical of our own government. We're very critical of our own environment because that's our job to do so. Other countries are dealing with far bigger inflation problems, but they've got the structures and the support networks to better cope than we do. And we're not pulling out all the stops to make sure that we do. And there will be consequences. Graham Koerner with a Kerner perspective this evening. Graham, tell me this big sell-off that we've seen sort of build in markets is sort of accelerating, I suppose, as the almost inevitable reality begins to dawn on us that, you know, without even a short, sharp recession, we're not going to get inflation under control anytime soon without some very serious interventions.
Yeah, good evening, Bruce. I think when you say, you know, South Africa have, we have our own challenges, the reality is, I think, in large part, I've said this many times, and I'll say it again, I think central banks were a big part of the problem in creating this chaos. There was a complacency. And, you know, our Reserve Bank, we'll see what they do next week this time, but the reality is our Reserve Bank, I think, has come through this whole monetary policy environment with flying colors. But unfortunately, I think, as you say, Bruce, there's no easy way out of this. You know, with inflation running at over 9 in the U.S., bond yields at, say, 3 on the 10-year, and everybody, you know, a year ago was with great confidence telling you the 10-year wouldn't go much above 2. I think a lot of people are battling the, I call it recalibration, you know. People are trying to figure out, well, where should we be? But it's very, very uncomfortable for equity markets, and particularly for things that are geared to growth. So, for example, if you look at our market today, the resources cluster, the Resi 10, was down, you know, brace yourself, 5.7%. So yeah. Anything that's geared to growth in the world is very, very vulnerable at the moment. It's not just the U.S. techs that are seeing those sort of historically lofty multiples shaved quite aggressively.
Yeah, and it's come through very, very strongly. FTSE down sharply on the day. European markets down between 1.5% and 2%. Similar drop-offs on U.S. markets today as well. We've seen commodity prices come off very sharply. They're coming off because There's an assumption that as economies slow down, as interest rates have to go up to fight inflation, there's less demand for commodities. So everything from the oil price to the platinum price is under pressure.
And if you think of things like iron ore, I mean, iron ore from those silly levels of, let's say, about a year ago, where everybody was falling over their feet to buy and there were, you know, supply issues and demand was booming and supply was constrained. And you're thinking about commodities like iron ore and copper, but, of course, you know, some of the precious metal cluster as well. The share prices just powered ahead, and I think a lot of us said, be careful, this is not going to sustain itself, and don't pen in those, you know, iron ore at $150 or $200 a ton, or copper at $10,000, and they're coming back to earth with a thud, and in spite of, you know, I think the assurances of the Chinese authorities that they will do what they need to do to get the economy going, I think it's going to take time. It comes back to what you were saying, Bruce. Is it going to be a J curve before things get better economically? They're probably going to get worse. So it's just a really bumpy ride. There's nowhere to hide at the moment. Even good companies that are on very, very attractive multiples are being marked down on a daily basis.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I mean, Wayne McCurry last night was very bravely saying, we're probably not at the bottom, but we're getting to a point where things are going to be cheap enough to start buying. I wonder whether or not you share that level of optimism, at least in the short term.
Well, Bruce, what I'll say is I don't have a golden phone on my desk that rings when we hit the bottom of the market and people will phone me and say, right, Standard Bank is turning, or, you know, Remgro, or Cup, or, you know, Fushini Group or anything. So I think, you know, if I look at companies like Fushini and Cup and Remgro and Standard Bank, I'd say if I look 2-3 years forward, arguably they've done a lot of good work. They've got better balance sheets. I think the outlook, in spite of this more recent turbulence, is probably better than it was a year ago. So I think you're buying really good companies on attractive valuations. So I would agree with what Wayne was saying, but I think my point, you know, somewhat facetiously is, you know, nobody tells you start buying. So I would say when you see value, long-term investors should be committing capital to this market right now. Don't wait for some signal that everything is over, because I think you'll look back maybe, you know, a year from now and say, geez, you know what, we could have bought some really good companies at ridiculously low valuations. And as I say, a lot of them, Bruce, have done really good work. When I say fixing, not only the balance sheets were broken, but a lot of companies like Fushini, you know, very low debt levels, Cup as well. And you just sort of say, well, you know what, even if we go through a tough period, it's not like they've got financial risk because of massive leverage. So, yeah, I think it's a good time to be adding, but you don't want to go and fill your boots. You know, you want to steadily buy on the way down.
Yeah, that is, I suppose, the art of investing in a nutshell. But yeah, things are fairly tortured at the moment, Graham. We've got huge pressure also on the currency, of course, and goodness knows where it goes this time. But everything is on the side of the dollar, because generally what happens is interest rates go up in big economies. Money floods toward the higher interest rates, toward the higher yield, because even if those economies are going to go into recession at some point in the not too distant future, there's always the assumption that you can trust the dollar. And the dollar, therefore, draws lots of cash. And that's precisely what's happening at the moment. As we look at the rand-euro exchange rate at 17.18 and the rand-dollar exchange rate at 17.20 this evening, they're neck and neck.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's because, euro-dollar's back at parity, which is the first time in 20 years. But I think you're right, Bruce. There's an old saying in the market that, you know, when the U.S. catches cold, the world catches a really bad flu. So I think there is an exodus out of anything other than the dollar towards the dollar. Of course, the U.S. has moved more aggressively, and I think the indications are they're going to move very aggressively at the next Fed meeting. Although the ECB has said they'll do the right thing, I think they generally seem to be behind the curve. So right now, there's a lot of momentum behind the dollar, but I think the reality of it is you are investing, you're getting very low yields on cash, and you've got an economy where inflation's running at an incredible 9%. So I think you sort of may be running somewhat into a burning building if you go pouring into dollar assets right now. I think, again, it's measured and just trying to take a long-term view. I would not be selling South African equities to go and buy, you know, U.S. 10 years, for example.
Thank you, Graham Koerner. The Koerner perspective this evening, Graham Koerner, regular Thursday night market commentator. Thank you very much for your insights this evening. Super Saver Julia, we catch up with her for once a year visit to Super Saver Julia into the inner workings of her investment portfolio. I'll fill you in on the details, but you'll be familiar with her. She's been talking to us at this time of year every year for the better part of the last decade. I've lost track. And she has grown the value of her money quite extraordinarily, particularly up until this time last year. I wonder what has happened. She got to a point. Let me summarize it for you. She got to a point in 2016 where she put away a total of 3.2 million rand over about 8 years. And that money had grown and grown and grown, and the portfolio was worth more than 3.2 million rand, but she's done nothing. From 2016 to this time last year, she did nothing. She added not a cent. She didn't mess with anything. She just left it. And she let the very wonderful power of compounding do what it does. And by the time we spoke to her this time last year, she had just a little less than 6 million rand. The power of compounding had doubled the value of her money. And that is the miracle of investing. I wonder how she has changed her strategy, changed her thinking, and how she is behaving differently, because everyone's behaving differently at the moment. I wonder how that is affecting her, and we'll talk to her about that at 7:30.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. We're going to talk about failures in municipalities next. What a cheerful evening we're having. But again, these discussions are unfortunately unavoidable, because we have to face the desperately unsanitary truth of state failure. I see, in a slightly more cheerful tone, Barbie, the company that owns Barbie, it's Mattel Inc., has unveiled a new Barbie. And the new Barbie is made from recycled plastic, and it's part of what it's calling its Inspiring Women series. And they've done a new Barbie in the form of, or at least paying tribute to, British primatologist Jane Goodall. And I think for a long time has hoped that Barbie would be taken a little bit more seriously. But Mattel have done the Barbie, the new Jane Goodall-inspired Barbie, dressed in a khaki shirt and shorts and holding a notebook. And the doll has got a pair of binoculars around its neck and also a replica of the first chimpanzee that Jane Goodall was able to gain the trust of. And that's David Greybeard. That was the name of the chimpanzee who first gave her a break, I suppose, in her massive conservation work. And Jane Goodall is 88 years old. She's been researching in East Africa since 1960. And she looked at the habits of chimpanzees and saw them make tools and hunt and eat food and eat meat. And the most important thing that she noticed was their ability to show compassion. And so, yeah, it's fabulous to see Barbie sort of, I suppose, catching up with the times. Perhaps Barbie's always been this massively superficial, mass-produced kids' toy, and even Mattel has had to catch up with the 21st century.
You're with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
One of the things I'm sure is frustrating you at the moment is the statements of the bleeding obvious coming out of government at the moment. Frustrating because the statements are not aimed at you and me. The statements are aimed at convincing the ANC to do its job rather than some great master plan on how we're going to take giant leaps forward that need us all to buy in. And today it's the turn of the Finance Minister, Enoch Godongwana, warning that municipalities should start playing a key role in growing the economy. No nonsense, Sherlock, really. Deal with service delivery or face instability and desperate people. That's the warning from Enoch Godongwana. The mere fact that he has to say it shows you just how far municipalities in many parts of the country have sunk. We've got some very good municipalities. We've got some very well-run municipalities, some high-functioning municipalities, which would be the envy of many around the world. But what we're seeing is massive downgrades of the ratings. I saw the city of Joburg had a downgrade today. Charles Cox is the principal ratings officer at Ratings Africa. And this frustration that we all feel with our municipalities, the municipalities which we as a broad electorate have voted into power time and time and time and time again, and expecting a different outcome, is more of a reflection on us, I suspect, than the people supposed to run the municipalities. But it is alarming, Charles. It's alarming that we need to be teaching politicians how to suck eggs in terms of stating the bleeding obvious. Municipalities have a critical role to fulfill, don't they?
Yes, absolutely, Mr. Whitfield. The shocking thing is that it's taken so long to make fairly soft statements. I still think that Mr. Godongwana's statements in this speech are fairly soft. He could have gone much, much harder. The fact of the matter is he doesn't really mention finance as much. He talks about service delivery and he, of course, stresses that people should be spending on infrastructure. All good things. But if you are deep in the hole, pothole or sinkhole, whatever you are, then frankly, this is second phase problem. The first phase problem is that you're in severe financial distress and have no money to pay your creditors tomorrow. And those creditors include Eskom, they include the water providers, they obviously include staff, and they include others that provide services to the municipality. If they turn off those taps, speaking in terms of services, the municipality really can't do anything.
And here's the point. I mean, out of, we've got 257 municipalities in South Africa, and nearly a fifth of those, 43, are in financial distress. Some, if there were corporations, would be bankrupt. But the big problem is the complete incapacity of many municipalities, nearly half of municipalities, to do even basic budgeting. And 112 municipalities of those 257 have passed budgets that they can't fund. There is not the money that they've budgeted for in the coffers or going to be available to them at any point in the future.
Correct. And they keep deluding themselves that their problems are minor.
So the finance minister is drawing attention to this. We've had many, many people drawing attention to failing municipalities all over the place. We've seen companies disinvest from towns where, you know, the potholes are so big that the trucks can't do deliveries or collections. We've seen multiple service failures across Standerton, across so many municipalities in South Africa, and companies have started to vote with their feet. Are the municipalities in such deep distress salvageable at all, in your view, Charles, or are these sort of lost cities in perpetuity?
Well, you know, once you've left, you know, moving is an expensive and a very difficult topic. Once you've left, the chance of returning is pretty small. So a municipality that's in deep trouble can only look at really
trying to get new businesses to establish themselves there in the future. I do not see it likely that you can retain a business that has already decided that it needs to move out. I mean, that's a dumb thing. So the question is, how does one create an attractive municipality? How does one draw people towards a municipality? Because those people will, in the months and years to come, pay part of the rates and tariffs. They will obviously increase the total economic activity in the area, which is all good stuff. But they will not come to a municipality that's in absolutely chaotic state.
We've shown that municipalities can be salvaged. We've shown that municipalities can be turned around. There are many cases in the Western Cape where the official opposition happens to be in power, but where a very strict regime of skills and the discipline have been in place for the better part of the last decade, perhaps a little bit longer. And we've seen a dramatic turnaround in the fortunes. We're seeing real attempts in other municipalities where opposition parties have taken control to do things better. It is possible, but it does take discipline and more than rhetoric.
We would like to underscore from our side that there seems to be no link between politics per se and the effectiveness of a municipality. There is a very, very direct link between the quality of management and that of management's attention to what has to be done, yes. But it's wrong to say that politics is the primary source of good or bad things happening. It's really the quality of the people that are in the management there. And the Western Cape is fortunate that they have, since about the late 70s, had quality people come in from other parts of the South African ethnic makeup. And those people have proven to be capable and good. They understand what has to be done, and they just keep doing it.
But again, it takes political will to ensure that you employ the right people, you appoint the right people to those positions of authority, you give them the budgets to spend. And if you appoint the wrong people into those positions, or you appoint your mates, or you appoint your colleagues, or you appoint your cadres into those positions, you are going to fail, ultimately, surely.
Yes, unless they have the technical skills to do the job well. And the technical skills in South Africa, of course, are in fairly short supply. So generally speaking, your point is valid. This one will be very clear. It's the council actually allowing good quality management to do the right things. Some of the things that good quality management have to do from time to time aren't palatable to a council that wants to be successful politically. Because sometimes you've got to spend money that will look bad on your balance sheet next year, but you have to spend it. Infrastructure is one specific case. You spend infrastructure funds in 1 year and maybe recoup it 20, 30 years down the line. Now, in the meantime, things don't look so good. You can't appoint so many people. And that is obviously something that a council doesn't want to hear. So a council effectively has to trust it has the right quality people in management, has to trust that they will be doing the right thing in terms of the bigger picture, the real strategy that municipalities have in South Africa. And that could possibly then lead to success, notwithstanding any political characterization of the council.
That is such a valuable point. Thank you, Charles Cox, the principal at Ratings Africa.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
So, for all the doom and gloom that's around, and we've been focusing a lot on that this evening, there are two things that are going to rock your world, surprise you, perhaps. One is a very strong economic indicator that says things aren't as bad as they appear. The other is a possible entry into South Africa by the world's biggest retailer. And it's not Walmart. Walmart already is in South Africa with Massmart, and that's not been the world's greatest success story. But Simon Brown, financial educator at Just One Lap. Now, how much certainty is there that those nice people at Amazon are entering South Africa? I've seen lots of speculation. I have people talking to me as if it is fact. What do we know in terms of Amazon and South Africa plans?
Evening, Bruce. As far as I understand, Amazon haven't said officially from their head office and wherever it would be in the US that we are here, we are coming, this is our D-Day. But from folks on the inside, all indications are that they're certainly ready. That they, for example, someone said to me that they had been looking for office space in Cape Town. Because, of course, they've got a presence down there already. But that's more call centers and some other bits and some of the AWS tech side. And we're a market that, we're not an insignificant market. And they've gone to all the the big ones. They're in Europe. They're in North America. I mean, they're in sort of the Australasia, New Zealand, and the like. And now, no disrespect to us, but they're coming to the slightly smaller markets, and we're definitely one of them. I mean, we've got the infrastructure in terms of delivery, in terms of payments and the like. We're comfortable and used to online. So whilst Amazon hasn't yet put their flag in the ground and given us a date, indications are that certainly they are.
I think you're absolutely spot on about that. I mean, it's great for, I think, South African consumers. Certainly a variety of buying, the purchasing power of Amazon worldwide is absolutely enormous. It must be terrifying for the likes of Takealot, the likes of Massmart, for example, who potentially in this process are the biggest losers.
I think so. I absolutely. And, you know, I mean, not you know, Takealot is perfectly fine, and they work, and I use them, as I'm sure you and many of your listeners do as well. And they, you know, they deliver the goods, the service is decent enough, the products are good, the prices are okay. But Amazon just take it to a whole new level. And of course, they're not just going to be, you know, putting up a .co.za store and selling us goods. They also are a marketplace, so people can sell through them at the same time. You can take whatever your product might be and put it on the .co.za marketplace with Amazon. Will they bring their Amazon Prime? In time, they probably will. This week there is Amazon Prime happening in the US, where they do, you know, sort of like a Black Friday type specials. But heck, they do it in the middle of the year because they're Amazon. Why not? So it's going to fundamentally raise the game. They've got massive brand awareness already. I think many South African online shoppers probably cut their teeth 10, 15, 20 years ago ordering a book or a CD or something like that.
Remember that.
From Amazon. Yeah, and it would arrive, and that was always the amazing thing. It would actually arrive, you know, a week or two or three later, because we didn't have it locally. So they've just got that brand. And of course, you know, to your point, they are a global player. And you know, Takealot's owned by NASPAS, and NASPAS is no slouch either. But Amazon has just got the buying power and the expertise. This is what they do. It is fundamentally in their DNA to drive up services and product offering and drive down costs for the users.
I can't imagine the welcome they're going to receive, because they're not great friends of the trade union movement. They're not great friends of government intervention, both of which are national sports, of course, of the South African environment.
I think you're right. I think there is. I mean, I think the retailers are not going to be happy. They're online. I mean, there's some of the niche ones like Yuppie Chef as well. But I think from the perspective of government, Amazon being in here, yes, the profit ultimately is Amazon's and it goes out the country. But it is going to create economic activity. It means that they're going to have, you know, warehousing, for example. And that's obviously going to, you know, it's going to need staff. It's going to need space. It's going to need all of those. But the unions, because that is the one place where Amazon in the U.S. gets a lot of stick, is the treatment of its people working in the warehouses, and then the folks who are actually physically doing the delivery. Some of it they contract out to third parties, but in the U.S. they're actually big enough to have their own Amazon delivery services. So I think the unions are going to be having a long, hard look at that. I think, make no mistake, I don't think Amazon's spoken to local unions, but I think Amazon's probably also had a long, hard look at our labor environment in South Africa, and fairly confident that they can make it work, and they can reach, you know, not a settlement, but they can find a space where the unions are mostly happy. And I say that because, you know, I've got a lot of respect for unions, but I think it's part of their DNA to not always be happy. That wouldn't be right.
There we go. Thank you, Simon Brown, financial educator at Just One Lap. Insights into a possible, even likely, entry of Amazon into South Africa next year.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. A surprising turnaround in thinking when it comes to the way in which the show has been playing out this evening, which has been very negative. It's been focused on a lot of the politics of the country at the moment and the consequences of neglect of management of the country. And that comes to the failures of municipalities. It's the huge surge that we see in a food secure country of food prices, putting basic foodstuffs out of the reach of so many. And government's apparent failure, at least according to Andy du Plessis, the managing director at Food Forward South Africa, to connect with him, and the huge pressure we put on the non-governmental organizations to do the job of government when it comes to basic food provision for many, many poor people in South Africa, are heavily dependent on the goodwill of others in order to survive, as food prices, the basic food prices that Andy du Plessis at Food Forward South Africa monitors, food prices up 13% over the last 12 months. And it's not the stuff of caviar and other expensive things. It is the very, very basics. But for every rule, there is an exception. And there's an astonishing data set today, which begins to suggest that as glum and as gloomy and as catastrophic as so much of what we are living through in South Africa at the moment may be, that there is actually some life in the South African economy that we didn't, possibly weren't aware that there was. And it comes through in what is happening in terms of cash movement and the movement of money in the economy, and bank transactions showing that perhaps the South African economy is actually growing faster than expected. According to Bankserve Africa, the Economic Transactions Index shows that cash transactions at least picked up sharply in the second quarter versus the first quarter, nearly 4% better off. Professor Adrian Saville, investment specialist at Genera Capital, is it worth paying attention to this particular statistic as an indicator of economic activity, Adrian?
Bruce, you know, there's two things that are really useful in this data. The one is it's very broad-based, you know, as opposed to much statistical data, which is sampling. And the second is it's about as close to real time, you know, as you get in terms of regular publications out of statistical releases. And, you know, that provides, you know, very helpful guidance that there are some things going on that appear to be better than at first blush. You know, my economic and investment language has lots of howevers, but maybe I should pause for breath before I do the howevers.
Okay, but before we get to the howevers, there is an indication, therefore, that there's plenty of economic activity, and the cash economy is often very difficult to measure. Therefore, when you look at cash transactions, as Bankserve Africa does in its Economic yes. Transactions Index, it tells you that there is money changing hands in return for goods and services at a level that is not reflected by something like GDP or other economic measures.
Agreed. So it's measuring parts of the economy that it would be unrecorded or, you know, or hard to measure. You know, just keep in mind that when someone moves cash, it very often moves quite quickly into the formal sector and does become measured, even if its first move or first transaction is unrecorded. So there's you know, there's some distance between informal and informal activity, but it's in the case of the South African economy, it's not a yawning deficit, but this does give us some useful guidance that is different from the other broad-based formal statistical releases.
However, you may now talk about the however.
Well. The however is this is a small part of the economy that the data is capturing. So although I'm describing it as broad-based and almost real-time, it doesn't reflect the rump of the economy. Even if it does, or the parts that it does, it leans in the direction of spending and in particular consumer spending, which is helpful to keep economic momentum. It's not really the seedbed of economic growth or sustained economic growth, job creation, gains in productivity and production. So it's measuring activity on what we call the demand side of the economy rather than the supply side or the production side of the economy. given the circumstances which you described, and you use some quite colourful language to point to what's going on in the South African economy, we shouldn't, you know, take away these small victories. But you know, the grumpy observation would be, you know, as much as this is a positive, what we're really looking for is changes in the production side of the economy that would be investment based. All of that said, this is a lovely positive print.
It is. Thank you, Professor Adrian Saville, Dr. Adrian Saville. More titles than howevers. Thank you. Investment specialist at Genera Capital, Dr. Adrian Saville, this evening. It's a tiny indicator that's, if nothing else, says the wheels are wobbly, the nuts need to be tightened, otherwise the wheels are going to come off. But hey, we've got enough money for a spanner now. Can we get somebody to tighten the nuts? I suppose is the question. But yeah, it's a lovely indicator. Also in a moment, an upbeat view on building your business. Pavlo Fatidi standing by with that. And we'll also do Super Saver Julia this evening. We haven't seen her for the past year. So we've got her, dusted her off, and asked her please to join us and to tell us what has happened to her investment portfolio. Tell you more about her if you've not ever stumbled across Super Saver Julia. Be prepared to be awed and amazed and intrigued by what she is up to at the moment as she changes her focus a little bit. I'm curious to catch up with her this evening and look forward to that a lot. In a moment, Pavlo Fatidi's at Auric Business Accelerator.
The Money Show.
Small business.
Pavlo Fatidi is this evening from Auric Business Accelerator with us to talk small business. And it's the first of a five-part series that Pavlo has plotted and planned and structured and created, because he's got big ideas, as our Pavlo, as to how to help you build a 100 million rand business. Seems impossible. That's what it seems, Pavlo. But tell me, please, how are we going to do this?
You know, Bruce, so many people have said to me, you know, I know someone who sold their company for 100 million rand. You know, not many people know about it. And wow, they were so lucky. Or, you know, just everything worked out for them. Or. And actually, it just got me thinking, because you really can architect this. You can really put a plan down, a long-term plan, a 20-year plan, to say, I'm going to start a business and I'm going to build it to 100 million rand valuation company, which I may or may not sell in the next 20 to 25 years. But it's a lot more than just hope and a prayer. There really is a fundamental strategy to it. So what I'd like to do is set the scene and share what we're going to do over the next, let's say, 5 weeks. And the reason it's 5 weeks is because valuation sits in five layers in a business. And each of these five layers changes shape over a period of time. If you think about the life cycle of a business, you start up a business, you've got to go through all the issues of dealing with a startup. Once you've got some traction in the market, you then want to scale up the business. Now that you know you've got something that's working, you want to scale it up. And once you've scaled it up, you then want to ramp up and really accelerate your revenue, but also deepen your profit. And then in the final act, this is 10, 15, 20 years down the line, you want to make very sure you lock in your value and ensure that you yourself are not the business. So these four, call it phases of development over time, occur across each of the five layers, which, Bruce, once built atop each other, holds the full potential of a 100 million rand valuation. It all depends, in terms of time, on your skill set, your history, the relationships you've earned, the type of business you've started in an industry that you may be familiar with or not familiar with, and obviously access to funding. Because to accelerate growth, it means that you're going to be growing a business way beyond your capability of financing it through your own balance sheet. So part of this, specifically in the ramp-up stage, across each of these layers, is how do you ensure you can make yourself look really good to either a banker or a funder?
Pavlo, should we mute you just for a moment? If I'm comfortable with the dogs in the background, it gives us a lovely homely feel, but I'm not sure if it's distracting you at all. There seems to be calm in the background now. Well, maybe that's because we muted a little bit. But that's what Pavlo's going to be doing over the next 5 weeks. And it's a wonderful breakdown, I think, of the process of creating a business and making sure that their business has a value. He's picked a level of 100 million rand. It's a value, but it's just a level. Don't get caught up in that necessarily, because not every business is going to grow to 100 million and some will grow beyond. It's the principles of what he's doing, from startup to scale up to ramping up and accelerating and then removing yourself from the business, the operations, the day-to-day stuff, so that when somebody buys your business, they're not buying you into some kind of servitude or slavery. That means you are beholden to what, you know, to the next owner of the business. You want to be able to get out of there in your own time when it suits you, when you've managed to sell that business, which of course is the big goal. Pavlo Fotidis, founder at Auric Business Accelerator. Are you back with us? The menagerie under control?
Yes, I think everything's back under control. Thank you for that.
There's nothing more disconcerting.
There's a new puppy on the team, so.
Oh, fantastic. Congratulations. We will now we understand context. I can go wild. Yes. So you're now in a club with Charlize and Christo Visa and the ESCOM chief executive, Andre De Reiter, and somebody else, all of whom, during interviews with me, have had dogs barking embarrassingly in the background. And Pavlo. Pavlo's dog barks at a moment's notice.
That is very unfair.
You mentioned, you know, people say, oh, they're so lucky. And, you know, through all of this, luck is an integral part of the process, but also luck is created through this process as well, because the right person in the right space at the right time who doesn't act in an appropriate way loses out on an opportunity just in the same way as somebody who didn't bother getting there in the first place. And so luck, I think, is pivotal, but you've got to spot the luck and act on it.
Yeah, very much so. But you know, there's a great way to actually ensure that you get luckier and luckier and luckier. And that is to have a couple of things in place. So the first thing is to start with the end in mind. And Bruce, when most people start a business, really the attention is all around, it's the idea, it's what I'm going to be doing, and it's how everybody responds to me. It's a deeply, deeply personal exercise. And very, very emotive and very emotional all the time. It can be very, very cloudy. But let's start with the end in mind. Doesn't matter how much you love your business. I love my business. I could see myself doing this forever and ever and ever. Honestly, I can. But the reality is that over a period of time, you eventually run out of gas, you run out of steam. There are only two outcomes. It's either going to be a business closure, or it's going to be a hospital pass to someone, which is like a business closure. We see that extensively in the family business environment. Or it's going to be an exit. And the exit should be one of the founding principles every day when you wake up in the morning as to why you do what you do. Despite the fact that it might be 20 or 30 years from now, it's like setting sail from a port. You don't set sail with a ship where you've got limited resources and you've got limited food, fuel, and water, and determine to yourself and decide to yourself, well, you know, I'll think about where I'm going one day. I don't feel like thinking about it now. So let me set sail from port, go out into the wild open sea, and, you know, hope that luck comes along and lands me safely in a harbor, in a destination somewhere exotic. You start with that destination clearly, clearly in mind. It's the first element of becoming a mindseted person around 100 million rand valuation.
Okay, so take me through it then. The startup phase, we've got a couple of minutes. I won't interrupt. I'm going to let you loose to fly free.
Okay, so the first thing is clear destination. The reason I'm doing what I'm doing is, yes, I'm doing it because I have to out of necessity. It gives me economy. I love what I'm doing. It gives me meaning. But ultimately, the purpose has to be those elements of passion. The purpose has to be that I'm building a saleable asset. And that means that you need to understand how valuation works in any business. Right now, you've started the business. It's worth absolutely zero, zip, nothing. But you have to still understand the mechanics of valuation, because valuation is made up 60%, maybe 70% mechanical, which you have full control over, and then 30 or 40%, it's about the packaging and presentation, which, Bruce, equally you have full control over. So in effect, that outcome, you have a significant amount of control over. You then have to make a commitment to deciding what you are doing on a day-to-day basis. Am I going to build a job for myself? And a job is where you are square and center of that business's survival. Your team can't function without everyday guidance and leadership. Your customers draw heavily on you. Your suppliers draw heavily on you. And it can give you tremendous meaning, and you can have a sense of tremendous importance and value. I'm working with a 79-year-old business owner at the moment, Bruce, who started their business 51 years ago, based out of Virginia in the US. And he turned around and he said to me, if I'm not there in a week, I fear for the estimation of work to be done that would set me back. Because one mistake when you estimate a job prior to committing to the job can literally sink this kind of business. They're involved in big steel works. And he says, as a result of it, I'm there day in and day out. I'm there in Monday to Sunday. He, after 51 years, having done exceptionally well for himself, has built a job, not an asset. An asset has three features to it. The first thing, it needs to have income growth. If you invest in any share on the stock exchange, you're going to be chasing some dividends. The next thing it has to have is capital value. You need to be able to deepen the capital value of that share. If you're buying a share for 50 Rand, you're hoping to sell it 3, 5, 10 years down the line for substantially more than 50 Rand. And the third thing it needs to have is tradability. So in the case of this individual, Bruce, 79 years old, proud of what he's built, some really significant projects that he built big reputation and brand out of. He is the doyen of the industry across the United States. He's completely, at this point in time, unable to demonstrate that he has built a tradable asset for the simple fact that without him there, the business doesn't function. He cannot sell it. It's the difference between a job and an asset.
Even the dogs agree. Even the dogs agree, Pavla. I think you're on point this evening. But it's that it's that for a lot of people, they're so busy hustling and they're so busy grinding and they're so busy working that this idea of starting with the end in mind is an impossibility, because they'll say to you, well, you know, yeah, I can draw up a business plan, but it's going to be irrelevant in a month. And this business, I think I know where it's going, but I don't know where it's going, you know. And every single CEO of a large startup, of a sort of the CEOs who founded businesses and stayed with the businesses for 20, 30, 40, 50 years in some cases, all say, I had no idea how big this thing was going to get. I had no idea what shape it was going to take. It was an opportunistic growth path as I went along. But I suppose if you're going sailing without a GPS nowadays, or without, at least without a map and a sextant, you know, you're not going to be able to navigate the storms very well.
Absolutely. You absolutely will not be able to navigate the storms at all, Bruce. And that's the thing. If you understand why you're doing what you're doing before you start, and you make a firm commitment with a profound level of foresight, because that's what it does take, that you're building something that needs to be shaped up into an asset. You've understood valuation, you have a sense of how valuation works in your industry, you have a sense that you need to have three criteria in your business, eventually, income growth, capital growth, and independence of you. And honestly, Bruce, I think the best way to navigate that, it sounds absolutely churlish, but until you see something every single day, you forget that it exists. Write it up, create a diagram, create a shape, create a symbol, whatever it may be, and put it up on the inside of your toilet door. Look at it every day to remind yourself that why you're doing what you're doing is to ensure that you're building a ship that will arrive at a destination where after 10, 20, 30 years, you can offload all the cargo and monetize the years and years and years of investment and risk that it takes. It's especially true in South Africa, where seemingly everything works against you every day in building that business. So from next week, we're going to start with layer one, and we're going to look at the four stages, starting up, scaling up, ramping up, and then valuing up layer one. And hopefully with that in play, the following week, we're then going to move to layer two and so forth, all the way through to 100 million rands worth of valuation.
I can't wait. Thank you, Pavlo Fatidis at Auric Business Accelerator this evening. Pavlo with our weekly small business focus. In a moment, personal finance. It's the time of year where we invite Super Saver Julia in. Lots of you love this feature. I'll introduce it in more detail and more absolute precision just after Eyewitness News.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance.
We spend one night of every July for the better part of the past decade speaking to Super Saver Julia. We've reflected on the really inspirational story of how from a relatively small beginning, she took a lump sum of cash on the advice of our regular personal finance guru, Warren Ingram. She invested it in the stock market across a range of exchange traded funds and at the time committed to invest a third of everything she earned. And she would then use another third to pay her taxes and another third for some fairly modest living expenses with a small flat, a small car and regular overseas holidays built in, believe it or not, in those days. Then there was a wobble in the global financial crisis and she suffered an understandable lapse in confidence and she regrouped herself and committed to keep up the ratio of a third of her income. And it rose, her income rose from 300,000 rand a year to, by the time she stopped working in corporate, to over a million rand a year. I've always get shouted at by people who demand that I find somebody of far more modest means as an example of what they could reliably do. And I would. I really would. We keep looking. But the reality is, if you're surviving, and surviving just, investing is hard. So your choices are going to be different to what Julia has done. The purpose of the Julia story, I say this every single year, people still shout at me. The purpose of the Julia story is to show you what is possible for young professionals who seriously want to apply themselves to growing in their jobs, growing in their professions, and building wealth. So you can shout away, but please don't expect me to engage on crazy stuff. Julia stopped adding new money to her South African investments in 2016, and she started a family. She bought a Volvo to replace her Corsa Light, which her husband then took over and started driving till the wheels fell off. She upgraded a small flat to a family home. And instead of adding to what at that stage was an underperforming ETF portfolio, she started using her extra cash to pay down her debt more quickly than she would otherwise have done. And that's put her in a position where the house is paid off, the car's paid off, and she's still got a good investment portfolio. By the time she stopped contributing to her investments, she'd put away about 3.2 million rand. And she avoided the temptations that many might take to buy a bigger car, a newer car, a flashier handbag, a flashier house, perhaps, or build a new wing on the house, whatever it was, cashing in the short share portfolio to buy a fancier lifestyle. She's avoided that. Instead, she left the capital alone and she used that cash freed up from her investing to pay down debt. By this time last year, despite drawing down about 141,000 rand to fund some pandemic expenses, she was sitting at nearly 6 million rand in investments. She'd earned 2.7 million rand from doing absolutely nothing. She kept tabs on her investments from time to time, but essentially she'd done nothing. And while that was happening, paying off her bond, making sure that the car was paid off, making sure that she was building up money for school fees, because, hey, kids need to go to school. She's with us again this evening, and as I always ask you, Julia, once I've done my summary, which gets longer and longer every year, that's broadly accurate, right?
That is an excellent summary, Bruce. I can't believe it's been over a decade and you managed to summarize that in less than 2 minutes. Well done.
That's your life. The story of your life the story of your life summarized in 2 minutes. That's so worthless. What have you been doing all this time? Now, listen, it's been a hell of a year, and particularly the last couple of months have been dreadful for investments. Before we talk about what you've been doing specifically, have you been shaken by the sort of rout that we're seeing play out in world markets at the moment?
Not myself, because as you mentioned, I've lived through one financial crisis, one recession. And so the second one hasn't shaken me as much as it has my husband, who kept telling me, oh, have you seen the stock markets today? It's all in the red. It's all in the red. And then we stopped looking. I told him, like, it's better to just not look for a few weeks, because it's so volatile. You can have a look at the status of your investments, and it can swing wildly, like hundreds of thousands of rands of difference from one day to the next. So yeah, the volatility has been a bit worrying, but luckily I haven't had to sell anything during this volatile time. So all these swings are theoretical gains and losses.
Yeah, exactly right. And they're on paper, and the paper is not as pretty as it used to be. But the point is, you've learned to understand that, you know, history shows us, and, you know, we believe history may never repeat, but it certainly rhymes, that these things will, in the broadest, biggest scheme of time, recover their losses and begin as cycles change. You critically gave up your day job. You had a very successful consulting career, and you gave up that job just before the global financial crisis hit, because you'd been working for many years towards starting your own enterprise. It's related to the travel industry. And of course, that got nailed. And I noticed that your husband, who'd been working for himself, has gone into a job. I don't know if he still got the job, but he did go into like proper full-time employment. So your family circumstances have shifted and changed a bit over the last couple of years.
Yes, it was just too tough for us to have two entrepreneurs in the family. So we did that over the 2 years of COVID. So from around March 2020, when the travel industry was so badly hit and I was just doing refunds. 2021, I made a bit of income from that business, but nothing significant. And we decided at the beginning of 2021 that we couldn't have two entrepreneurs in the family. It was just too stressful for us. So my husband said he'd give me a chance at starting something and growing and creating a business, which was very kind of him. And he went out to look for a job, and it took a few months. But he found one. And so having the stable income is great, because then we know that our expenses are, our monthly expenses can be covered from that. All the school fees, food, electricity, when we get it, and that kind of stuff. So yeah, it has helped to have that stable income.
Okay, let's get down to the brass tacks of what the investment portfolio has done. I described how you, in total, into these various exchange-traded funds into which you've invested, have put in 3.2 million rand in your own money, your earnings, share of your earnings. And by this time last year, that had gone to nearly 6 million rand. You'd taken out 141,000. You have in the last year, have changed something quite dramatic. Take me through what you've done and why.
So in the last year, I wasn't earning any income, because my business wasn't earning enough to pay out an income to myself. And I thought it might be a good time to realize some of my capital gains. So this was towards the end of 2021, where the stock market was towards its peak, not at its peak, but, you know, it was getting there. And I thought, I'm in a lucky position to have a lot of capital gain, because this money has been invested for a very long time since I've been speaking to you. So for over 10 years, 15 years, this money's been invested. So the capital gain was quite high. And there's a tax calculator that anyone can access free of charge. I think I used the Tax Tim one, but there's a lot of different tax calculators you can use. And I did some examples of what kind of capital gains I would pay if I had an income or didn't have an income. And it looked like it was a good time to realize some of those capital gains. So I decided to sell just over 800,000 rands worth of my MSCI World shares. So I sold those around November last year, and I decided to take those offshore, that money offshore. And I luckily, this was just pure dumb luck. I didn't invest everything at once. I invested it slowly into the stock market.
Where have I heard this advice somewhere? Warren. Oh, yes, that's him. Don't throw everything into the market at once. If markets are volatile and going up and down, then you put a little bit in every month over a period of time. Dollar cost averaging, exactly right. So you're sticking to the playbook. Good. Sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, so I just did that because I was happy to have done that because since January, the stock market has been on a downward trajectory. So it's helped that I invested some of the money only later on in the year. So, yeah, so I realized these capital gains, I have a nice big capital gains tax bill to pay SARS around about now. But it's much less. I think I worked out it was 30,000 Rand less than I would have paid if I'd had any salary, even the tax-free salary amount. So I think it's up to 90,000 Rand you can get tax-free. So because I had zero income in the last year, it had about a 30,000 Rand impact on the capital gains I had to pay. So yeah, that's what I decided to do. So that's where I'm sitting at right now.
Okay. So you did a couple of things. You utilized your offshore allowance. Everyone in South Africa who's lucky enough to have R1 million can take R1 million off offshore, no questions asked by SARS. If you want to take more, you need to, or by the Reserve Bank, you need to get permissions and stuff. So you've utilized within that offshore allowance, your 800,000 Rand. You've taken it offshore. Now, can I be so rude as to ask where that money has gone?
Yes, I've got a stockbroking account, just a cheap and easy to use stockbroking account in France, and I invested that money. So I sold MSCI World shares in South Africa, and I just put them back into MSCI World shares, but offshore. So okay. It was like for like. I didn't do anything fancy or anything really. Yeah. It's in a different exchange-traded fund because the one in South Africa and the one in France are different, but it's the underlying shares the same. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Excellent. And so you got like for like. You would have, at the time, you would have done well on the exchange rate. Of course, the euro, unfortunately, has lost quite a lot of value so far this year. So are you in the black or are you in the red following that decision?
I'm in the black. So, yeah, that's quite fortunate because I think most people would not be.
Okay. That's good news. I want to find out how you did it. And also, if you can do the sums for us in your head, because you've got a very good head on your shoulders. As to, you had a little less than 6 million Rand this time last year. What the grand total is now that you've done this restructuring of part of your investments. More with Julia, Super Saver Julia, in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, proud gold sponsor of the 5th Pension Funds and Alternative Investments Africa Conference. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal finance.
So how much of a capital gains tax bill have you got, Julia? How much money can we get from you into the fiscus, please? Because we need as much as we can get.
It was, the capital gain was 550,000. That was the capital gain. I think, right. I sold 800,000 rands of shares, and of that, 550 was capital gain. So, but I can't remember how much tax it is. I still have to do my tax return. So I'm not sure how much tax they'll charge me. It will be probably about 50,000, maybe less.
Okay. So you kind of, you've taken a 50,000 Rand knock on the value of your investment portfolio, and you then would have paid a little bit of money to translate the rands into euros, and then in your stockbroking account, some fees, I suppose, to buy more MSCI offshore assets. And I wonder what the value of those assets are now. Give us the overall value. You had just under 6 million Rand this time last year. Where are you sitting now?
Well, if we convert it to rands, it's just about 6.2 million.
healthcare. Well, we are converting
for the combined value.
That's the only way I can keep track. I mean, it just goes to the point here, Julie. I mean, you've not added money. You've every year you've tweaked and changed things a little bit, but you've not done anything dramatic. This is the most dramatic thing you've done in a couple of years. Mm. And, you know, you've taken the knock on capital gains because you're going to have to take it at some point anyway. And you've taken a deliberate decision to remove money from a South African environment into an offshore environment. It does leave the lion's share, though, of your investment portfolio in rands domiciled in South Africa. Is the plan each year to reduce that exposure to South Africa?
I'll start by taking all of the MSCI World shares that I own in South Africa offshore. So right. I would start by doing that. I would still always keep some South African shares. I like the Satrix 40. I'm traditional and boring that way. I just like I have very simple strategy with regards to that. But I will always have an exposure to South Africa, I think. We, being from a mixed nationality family, so my husband is not South African, we might at some point go to Europe. And so it's important to have money in the currency that you will be spending in. So if one day for some part of our lives, we don't view it as like forever after, but for some part of our lives, if we will be living in Europe, it will be good to have some euro-denominated investments. So that's the idea, and that's the plan. A sort of medium-term plan is, I would say, next 2 to 3 years is definitely to be in South Africa, but we might go to Europe for, say, 10 years and then come back here. So, yes, that's the idea, is to have some assets and some investments in euros, because that would be where we would go, if anyway.
Okay. Got you. And then just very, very briefly, I mean, your business, is it beginning to come back to life once again?
Oh, yes. It's amazing, the recovery in tourism. It's wonderful. It's so wonderful to see. It was such a difficult 2 years. It was really awful. I mean, I just had the worst luck leaving my corporate job before the pandemic and starting a business in tourism, but it's been worth it because all of that hard work for no reward for the 2 years of the pandemic has paid off. And I've just been getting the most wonderful word of mouth referrals, and yeah, people are wanting to come back, travel to South Africa. So yeah, very happy about that.
That's wonderful, Julia. Thanks so much indeed. Super Saver Julia this evening on The Money Show. Portfolio keeps on growing. She doesn't do very much to it. She doesn't have to be fancy with it. Slow and steady as she grows. Thank you, Julia. Super Saver Julia in July on The Money Show.